Sheree, and welcome to Bossy of the People. It is February, which means it's Black History Month, but this is not a regular Black History Month. This is the 100th anniversary of commemorating Black history in the United States. Negro History Week started in 1926, and then we get Black History Month in 1976, and here we are 100 years later. We are pumped about this episode. It's me, Miles, and Sharonda here to cover all the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you might not have heard a take on elsewhere. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People. Here we go. You see the headlines, ICE and the war on immigrants, federal police takeovers in major cities, racial profiling. How did we get here? Crooked's award-winning podcast, Empire City, the untold origin story of the NYPD, breaks it all down. Host Chinjerai Kumanyika traces how the biggest police force in the world was built and what that history tells us about power, policing, and public safety today. Chinjerai is also hosting a virtual Crooked Ideas Empire City Podcast Club kicking off March 31st. Together, you'll dig into the themes of the show, connect the dots, wrestle big questions, and imagine what real safety could look like for all of us. Sign up at crookedideas.org/empirecity. And if you're in Pittsburgh, join us February 17th for a night of learning and discussion in response to community concerns about public safety, featuring Chinjerai Kumanyika alongside Congresswoman Summer Lee. Get your free tickets at crookedideas.org/empirecity. This is Arrest Central with this administration, it seems. Here we go. This is Dre at DRY on Twitter.
That is, except for my newly free men in Louisiana who broke out of jail. While others are getting locked up, others are getting free. This is Miles E. Johnson at Sun Pulpit on Instagram.
And this is Sharonda Bossier at Bossier Shay on Instagram. What a wild week it's been. I feel like the biggest story has been the arrest of two journalists and two activists related to the church protest in Minneapolis. So as you all saw, federal agents arrested Don Lemon and Georgia Fort, who were two journalists and two Black Lives Matter organizers, Treherne Cruz and Jamel Lundy. We had a chance to see some of the footage of their arrests and also some of the footage once they were released from jail. So yeah, want to hear from y'all, like, what's striking about that for you?
So I don't know what I was doing, but all of a sudden I see the alert that Don Lemon has been arrested. And I'm like, what? You know, because I had just seen that 2 days before, they tried to arrest him unsuccessfully. The judge was like, he didn't do anything. He obviously wasn't an activist. He obviously wasn't a protester. And Don Lemon didn't break into a church. So like, the judge was very clear about that. But they didn't arrest Nakima and they arrested the other actors. So when I saw the alert, I was like, oh, this is nuts. It doesn't make sense to me. This is certainly going to backfire. But it also highlighted to me how far they're willing to go to accomplish the goal. Like, they are like, you know, in another time, that backlash or something like this, I feel like would be so strong that it would be, you just wouldn't do it. But they're like, it don't matter. And, you know, CNN releases a strongly worded statement. The NABJ releases a statement. Don comes out, and Don is Don. He does press. He's like, you know, I won't be beaten up about this and da-da-da. So that was interesting. And, you know, Don will manage this message. I hope that his arrest actually helps people understand just how wild the moment is, because I've seen people sort of excuse it or like just make excuses about why they don't need to pay attention. So I hope the Don thing helps them pay attention. But what actually shocked me was the video from the Black woman journalist whose name I do not have on hand, but Georgia is filming it from inside her house, and you see the agents outside. She's narrating. She's like, my kids are here. And, you know, obviously my day job is around policing. But the thing that I always have to remind myself is that it only takes one person to change your life. One random government official who decides to send the police to your house. One agent that shows up at your door. Like, and they are some of the most privileged people because, you know, their arrests become these national stories and da-da. But I was like, I had never heard of her before. And all of a sudden, she is like now part of this national firestorm. But this administration is just willing to go hard. And the last thing I'll say is that it also reminds me, I don't know if we talked about it here, but the FBI raiding the Washington Post reporter's house, because a lot of people have whistleblown to her or like had leaked information or complained about the administration. And the FBI raids her house. And you're like, they really are going, you know, full throttle to make sure that the media does not criticize them.
So I remember, I think I put this in the group chat, I believe, that I kind of secretly hoped that Don Lemon would get arrested. Mm-hmm. This is way before there was anything for him to get arrested about. I wouldn't have said that on air because I don't wish that on anybody, just like happenstance. But I thought he would be a really good person to get arrested. And I have to be honest with you, now that it has happened, I'm like a little deflated by it. Like, I think I had like this kind of weird thing in my imagination where it was going to maybe illuminate some of his like neoliberal audience to some stuff. I thought that maybe it was also going to give a pathway for the Democrats, like the kind of like establishment Democrats, to be more aggressive or just to unleash something. But it just didn't. It just kind of like folded into like, you know, that kind of soft milquetoast nothing that like everything on the left kind of gets like folded into. And it just was like, oh, this is just another thing for the newly radical wine moms to like talk about. But like, it's not getting to that point that I have in my imagination. So yeah, I kind of feel a little lukewarm about it now that this happened.
Yeah, I mean, I just like, is it for you anyway, because they didn't spend a lot of time in jail? Or like, what is it? You just haven't seen the reaction you thought you were going to see?
Wait, can we get t-shirts made that say, is that all there is? Because that that was a line. Miles, I'm going to give you that. We only are talking for 5 minutes. Is that all there is? Is a line.
Well, we will definitely get sued because that is taken by one Peggy Lee, one of my favorite vocalist, white woman vocalists. You know, I love a Doris Day. I love a Peggy Lee too. I exist in multiplicities. but yeah, I think probably what's more so attached for it for me, and I've had like conversations digitally about this, like with strangers, like in the comment section, and then of course with like friends and stuff like that, that like this moment specifically for us who have always been young, but always inside of the working poor, always maybe interested in radical politics, it has been so like illuminating how things aren't going to change. It has been so illuminating that like no matter how big like the fascist regime gets, nothing's going to necessarily open people's minds on either side to the whole system needing to be revolted against. And like, I think in my head, I thought Don would be like some type of catalyst. Obviously not it, because Trump did it to Don, but I thought it was going to be more of a catalyst. It's disappointing to see how it just goes right back to bipartisan news as usual and not anything more elevated than that. Because just in my head, this would be the thing that made me think differently about law and order. This will make me think differently about the constitutions and the institutions and the documents that we pledge allegiance to, and what maybe now that we see that there is no rules and there is no law and there is no order, what should we be doing now based off of those new rules? But, you know.
Yeah, I think it's telling for me that like they went after Black reporters and Black organizers first, right? Like going after the Washington Post reporter in some ways kind of makes sense, right? Based on their logic, because this person had been covering for whistleblowers, right? What is interesting to me though is like, again, the targeting of Black organizers and journalists, but also because they were disrupting a religious service, which is also like the optics of that provide a little bit more cover. So I'm wondering if we think the combination of like this being about Black journalists and organizers and the disruption of a religious service provided just like the perfect set of conditions and the perfect cover for them to go in, or if we think they'd go after these folks no matter who they were. Dere, you got thoughts on that?
I do-ish. What I'm about to say, I can't attribute to my own wisdom, but I swear to God, I like watched a video or something that said this in a much longer way. But I do think that the last decade of protests, like when I was in the street, it was new to us and we were all shocked by every arrest and every tear gas and every da-da-da. And there's something that's happened that I'm very neutral about, but that has been absorbed into the culture. So like Don's arrest 10 years ago would have been truly wild. And now it is sort of like another arrest that happens that is, I don't know, Miles probably has better language for it, but like the spectacle is not spectacle-y anymore because it's sort of just like in the air. The hard part is that there's a style of organizing and a style of activism that relies on the spectacle. And you know, like, what do you do when it doesn't spectacle the way the spectacles. Like, you know, they used sort of like that is sort of an interesting thing. And I will say, you know, at work, we're trying to work on this, but I've seen 8 million things about ICE being bad, and there is actually a consensus about it, which it feels really interesting. Like, at least on the left, in a way that, what does abolish ICE actually mean in real life? I don't know. I've talked to the pollsters. I'm as nervous as anybody else that people actually mean no more bad officers. They don't mean no department that is ICE, right? We live through this with the defund space. But a lot of people are pissed off. But the question becomes, like, what do you do with it? And that is where I feel like people get stuck. So when I think about, like, Don or any of this stuff, it's like, if we don't figure out how to put forth a vision for, like, structurally how to get there, I do think we will find ourselves rehashing exactly what happened in 2020. Because it's, in my mind, the only image I can have is, like, there'll be all this energy with nowhere to go. It's sort of like energy that's in a bottle just swirling around. And I feel like we are in the bottle swirling. Because there isn't like a clear thing. Obviously, we can do what Bernie. I don't know if you saw the vote, but Bernie actually did put a resolution to at least get rid of the $75 billion, like to cut back that. And it didn't pass, but it got all the Dems and actually got a couple of the Republicans. So that is an option. But yeah, what it feels like to me is like there's all this energy in a bottle swirling around. It's a lot of energy and it's a tight bottle. But the question is, like, where does it go? And I think Don's arrest is another good thing swirling the energy in a bottle. But I don't think it has a place to go.
I think also about, like, the chilling effect that these arrests have on people who might be thinking about, like, actually doing something disruptive, right? We've been talking about what can people do to actually gum up the works. And, like, if you can be shot for standing in between an ICE officer and someone that they're pushing, right? If you can be arrested because you participate in the disruption of a church service, then are people going to start to think differently about how willing they are to put their lives, right, on the line to try and gum up the works is a question that I have.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Sometimes it can feel like everybody else has it all together in their love lives. And I'll tell you, I look around and it's like, I know so many people married, they're super dating, they are recently single, but they want to be recently single and da da da. But I'll tell you, we're all figuring it out. And no matter where you are on your romantic journey, therapy can help you find your way, help you determine what you want, what feels heavy, what feels light, and how you can take some pressure off yourself. And we get it. February is full of flowers, candy, stuffed animals, and of course, lots of talk about relationships and dating. And no matter where you are, whether you're married or dating or single or just focusing on you, you're right on time. Therapy can help you find your way and see more clearly where you want to be. You know, I have the best friends in the world. And I haven't dated a lot. I've been busy. And I'm like, just trying to figure out, like, what am I doing when, you know, I ask somebody on a date or they ask me on a date. But therapy's been really helpful for me to just, like, be honest about, like, what do I want in a partner? What are my non-negotiables? What makes me happy? What makes me feel special? What can I offer to somebody in a relationship? How can I be my best self emotionally? And it's cool to know that you don't have to be on this journey alone. And that's what I love about BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and they're fully licensed in the United States. And they do the initial matching work for you. So you can just focus on your therapy goals. There's a short questionnaire that helps identify your needs and preferences. And their 12 plus years of experience and industry leading match fulfillment rate means that they typically get it right the first time. And if you aren't happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. And with over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people. Potsy the Beam is brought to you by HelloFresh. Now, nothing hits home like home cooking, and HelloFresh makes it easy to do more of it this year with recipes that feel good and taste delicious, night after night. Now, I love eating home cooking, but I am not a great cook. I don't even think I'm much of a cook, partly because it's not that I don't know my way around the kitchen, but I get stressed out about, like, what to buy and portions and da-da-da. I just, like, need help. And that's why I love HelloFresh, because it, like, all comes easy to use. You know, for me, I'm like, there's a recipe, the ingredients, like, all that stuff is just there in a way that allows me to not have to stress out about everything. And you can choose from more than 100 recipes every week, including cuisines from around the world and meals that help you beat the winter blues. I love the portion sizes too, because, and they have bigger portion sizes than they used to have. because sometimes I'm like a little hungry and I love a good leftover. And you can choose from more than 35 high protein recipes each week, including new Mediterranean and GLP-1 friendly options. And it feels great that they use wholesome ingredients like sustainably sourced seafood and 100% antibiotic and hormone-free chicken. There's now 3 times of seafood for no upcharge, and you can impress your guests or just treat yourself with new grass-fed steak ribeyes. And there's seasonal produce like pears, apples, and asparagus. Because when dinner tastes this good, nothing hits like home cooking. I love HelloFresh because it is the only way that I really know how to make my way around the kitchen, and you can too. Go to HelloFresh.com/people10FM to get 10 free meals plus a free Zwilling knife and $144.99 value on your third box. Offer valid while supplies last. Free meals applied as discount on first box. New subscribers only. Varies by plan.
I think also about the sort of the proxy stress, right? So like I feel very anxious in this moment, right? There were a set of demonstrations in Los Angeles at one of the federal detention facilities downtown. The officers are spraying people with pepper spray, right? They're doing the thing that they usually do with their quote unquote less than lethal rounds. And even though I was not in town for that set of protests, right, I'm watching the footage and I'm checking on my people and I can feel the stress in my body. I can feel myself be triggered by what I'm observing. And it is making me think differently about how I want to show up in this phase of my life, right? As someone who's a little older, as someone who's gotten a little bit more set in her ways, right? And as someone who was like, I don't know, maybe I'm not a street protester anymore. But it also made me think a little bit about like the impact on my health and on my body. We've talked a lot about one of the reasons why all of us actually on this pod are so invested in our physical well-being right now is because we feel like that's a way to resist the system and the system's attempt to take us out the game early. And I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about the Washington Post reporting on Black mortality rates, right? And how much of the difference between the average lifespan for white people and the average lifespan for Black people in this country can be attributed to stress and thinking about what we are all experiencing and seeing in this moment as another example of the kind of weathering that they talk about that wears on Black people.
I am so tired of these reports. Like, I'm like I'm so tired of them. If anything is published that tells me, oh yeah, white supremacy is a system and the system is working, any all the different ways to say that, I'm really, 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 really exhausted by those things. And for like really briefly, just so I can tie in what I was saying earlier to this point too. So I was in the digital wilderness commenting on people's stuff and being a troll. And so I got into a dispute with somebody who had commented on something that I said, and it kind of stopped me in my tracks because it paralleled so much of what like I hear people say in my life. And I just want like to read a little bit from it. I'll leave the person's name out just in case they, you know, even though it's public, but you know, whatever. I hear you, but this is America. How many times do we need to be told that both parties are vile? We pick the lesser evil and fight them while attempting to build a more radical world. Unfortunately, we will never have a progressive or radical candidate. Even amongst the Marxist, communist, and socialist parties, I don't hear any of them talking about Nat Turner or John Brown. I fear a lot of us don't know the cost of real change, war, and bloodshed, and we have to be the ones to deliver it. There is no other way. Any other conversation is privilege, and I say this with love. Do you still think that America will give up its power? The natives still aren't free. Hell, we still ain't free. The bigger picture is revolution that we are afraid to have. And, you know, I lived in hoods everywhere. I lived in the hoods in Atlanta, now in the Midwest. I was in Flatbush and Crown Heights in my time in Brooklyn. And anytime I would talk to people who were not engaged in politics or people who were newly not engaged in politics, they all came with the same conclusion that the only way to actually get freedom is through bloodshed, and we are a convenient, comfortable generation who would rather complain about it than do those things. And then also, you know, suicidal in some ways, but, you know, maybe not suicidal enough in other ways. So, like, people are like, my life ain't that bad. I'll take a little vote of suppression in something in my water rather than, you know, doing what it has to be done. And I'm not here trying to, like, advocate for violent revolution, but what I am thinking about often is how do most people feel? And mm-hmm. I think that was the kind of like my thing with the Don Lemon thing is that this kind of, I'm growing more and more frustrated with this like Black neoliberal class that is super loud. And then we see the results of it and we see more people not voting. We see more, and I hear more people talking about violent revolution than I've ever talked about, which to me also sounds like they do not believe in the peaceful routes anymore. And that to me is what's been swirling in my head. I don't have an answer for that. I'm just, it's what's got me down.
Miles, I actually, so I'm with you there in a way that I didn't anticipate that I'd be with you.
You're not with me because I didn't say nothing because you can't sue me.
Oh, goodness. But I would put something like, I would put something sort of before what you said is that I feel like in my own sort of arc, I've seen the general space become smarter about things that they were not smart about. Like they sort of just have like the public conversation has moved around race and justice in a way that's really cool. But what it hasn't moved around is solutions that people can galvanize around. So like I think about ICE, I think about the end of the police, whatever, is that I think there has to be a rallying cry that people can like see for them to say whether they're willing to risk their life for it. And I actually don't think that has ever been delivered for people. And I think that something as nebulous as that people experience as nebulous as like defund or abolish ICE or da-da-da is not enough. Like there's not enough there for anybody but the farthest left to be willing to risk their life about. And I think about it because like we were in this policy meeting about ICE the other day, and you know, there are all these interesting things that you actually can do. But like there's this question of like how far should Border Patrol be able to patrol the border? And half of our team is like, they should just literally be able to patrol the border. Like 1 mile. Like if you sneak past Border Patrol and you win, you got it. You know, like it's over. And then some people are like, you know, 10 miles or 20 miles. But I say that to say in a small way, that was like one of a package of things. But it's like, that at least is clear enough for you to be like, I'm willing to fight for that. Like I can fight for one of these options. And I do think that I want to figure out how we give people things that feel more tangible for them to fight about. I too am actually frustrated by the stress studies that are like Black people really stress and therefore die early. Not because it's not true. I know it's true. And I'm not even frustrated because I think there's a fatigue with people knowing it's true. My frustration is that I don't think people know what to do with it. And I think that people get overwhelmed by hearing all these things and not having a, like, again, it's like the bottle with all the energy and it's nowhere to go. I think that is driving people crazy and that makes me nervous.
I mean, we've talked about a number of ways, though, right, that people are reacting to this kind of research, right? You've got Rest is Radical, right? You've got NAP Ministry. You've got people who are like, I'm moving out of a big city, buying myself some acres out here, growing all my stuff, living my slow days, right? I'm a homesteader now because that works better for me. It's, you know, in all of the ways that we talk about the things that impact our health. And so I do think we are starting to see Black people in ways that, you know, we can say, again, like, this system is going to have to work harder to kill me, you know? And I don't always know if we are doing the work of helping people realize how many options there are to take better care of themselves in this system. I do think that, you know, we've also talked a lot about this, right? The importance of community and leaning on each other in this moment, because that's the only way that we make it through. And that's the only way that some of the things that are stressing us out become a shared burden or, you know, load. But I'm curious, Miles, like when you hear, you know, people talk about literally extracting themselves from a system that tries to extract so much from them. I know you've had like your own phases of thinking differently about your diet, right? Like you've been a raw food vegan, you know, like those kinds of things. Like how much of that is also about insulating yourself from this system that is out to destroy you?
Yeah, that kind of like goes into what I was thinking as like kind of both of you were speaking. Like, and again, I think that when I speak like this, like, I fear I sound pessimistic or nihilistic, which I'm not around my, like, own individual life. I'm not even around that, like, when I think about the grand scheme of things. But it's like, so many of these decisions have been made. So, like, by the time I decide to be a raw food vegan and I take my own individualistic, individual steps to do that, those decisions have been made. By the time somebody has said, oh, I'm going to live off the grid or do those things, people are already choosing individualism. By the time somebody decides that I'm going to take my health in my own hands and I'm going to get this amount of protein and this vegetable and I'm going to do all this stuff because I already know the medical industry is not going to be there for me, and damn sure it's probably not going to be there for me in 20 years when I turn 50 or 30 years when I turn whatever, you know, whatever. Those decisions have already been made, which help exploit the people who can't make those decisions even better, and helps the people who are already making those individualist decisions not care about bettering a system because they already made their individual system. And I think that's just where America is going. I think that is where we are at. I think that's where we are going, and it's only going to get worse and worse and worse. I was watching a couple of videos around this podcaster named Asmund Gold, and he's a far right podcaster, really disgusting person. But Hassan Piker got taken off of Twitch, and he was using Asmund Gold as an example of somebody who has language on Twitch and has said vile things on Twitch and who has not been banned, right? And Hassan got banned for saying Zionist pig, and this person said so many things. So as I was listening to Asmund Gold, I was chilled, not by the hate, I was chilled by the accuracy. I was chilled by the fact that he was saying that we are eventually going to have power as white supremacists. Everybody knows it. That's why they're not capitulating to the left. That's why they're not doing this. And all these kind of neoliberals on the left who are still going to incrementalize themselves and distract themselves by these little edits they can do to these policies, that it's a part of the plan, because what we're doing is going to be so quick, so big, so fast that all the shit that they're worrying about won't even matter because they're going to be locked out by the time we're in power. And that reorients priorities to me. You know what I mean? Again, not just because he said it or whatever, right, but it's what I've already been feeling and what history has already shown me.
I'm compelled by that actually quite a bit.
I'll send some videos, child.
No, I'm not compelled by it. I'm not.
No, say more.
I think that white supremacists have successfully commandeered the internet. And I think the successful commandeering of the internet is perhaps skewing our understanding of something. And I think that if we can figure out how to do the offline stuff and be sneaky and really as brilliant as white people have always been on the internet, I think we got this. Because I don't think none of us think the white supremacists are particularly smart, but I do think they have mastered the commandeering of all of the things that we use to get this far the first time. And they are yeah, this is bad. Let us just take our final swing. I understand why they would say a version like that, but that is a part of what they do, is that they tell these lies so crazily that we start to entertain them in general. I mean, this is what is Trump?
I don't want to misrepresent what he was saying as oh my goodness, he was saying this crazy thing. Here it is, right? I think that I probably, to a lot of people, say things that are bold, but I'm I kind of feel like y'all are not in the present. I feel like y'all are not y'all are not really here right now. So I'm able to kind of see past the spectacle of what he's trying to present, but you can't deny the function of it. You can't you can't deny the truth that there are white supremacist Democrats. You can't deny the fact that there are people who are working with Republican parties, and that is one of the reasons why the Republican Party can be so racist and so oppressive right now, is because there's been Democrats colluding, and there will still be Democrats colluding. And I believe truly that one of the reasons why there's not as much force from the Democrats is because a lot of them are just trying to see how this goes. And a lot of them are just trying to see where this is going. And if they have to be in service of Nazis in 10 years, then that's what it's going to be. And I think the reason why it kind of just circles in my head so much is because I think I'm starting to find it very deeply irresponsible to not really tell Black people what's going on, and what would I think of myself if in 15 or 20 years, Asmund Gold or somebody who was a fan of him or Nick Fuentes is in power now, and now the things and the violences that we see are even worse, or, you know, specifically now. And that's kind of what's been shaking my spirit now.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. I've been a Squarespace user since 2014. I love Squarespace. in 2014, I needed to figure out how to have a high quality site that like looked amazing, had a lot of functionality, but I'm not a developer. I like don't know how to code a single thing. And Squarespace was my solution then, still is my solution. And it's gotten even better over time, especially if you have a service or you have a business, because Squarespace offers a whole suite of things to help you offer services and get paid all in one place. From consultations to events and experiences, you can showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. You'll get paid on time with professional on-brand invoices and online payments. Plus, streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools. And you'll get discovered fast with the integrated Squarespace SEO tools because every website is optimized to be indexed with meta descriptions and auto-generated sitemap and more. So you show up more often on search engines and bring in more of your ideal customers. And you know, every dream needs a domain. Squarespace domains make it easy to find the best name for your business at one fair, all-inclusive price. No hidden fees or add-ons required. Every Squarespace domain comes with advanced privacy and security tools included to ensure your domain remains online and protected. Plus, Squarespace provides everything you need to bring more of your dream to life, whether that means building a website or adding a professional email service. Don't wait to claim your name. Invest in your dream today. And you can fundraise directly on your website if you have like a nonprofit or whatever you need, because there are built-in donation tools. You can create a professional on-brand website that makes it easy to accept one-time or recurring contributions and engage supporters. And with built-in email campaigns and marketing tools, you can connect with your community and inspire more people to support your cause. Squarespace makes it easy to showcase your expertise and engage clients also with video content on your website. You can upload and organize your videos, create stunning video libraries, and even monetize your content by adding a paywall. Perfect for online courses, exclusive tutorials, and premium workshops. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/PSTP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/PSTP. Pods of the P was brought to you by Acorns. So many people are focused on where their money is today. Acorns is a financial wellness app that cares about where your money is going tomorrow. And with the Acorns potential screen, you can find out what your money is capable of. Acorns is a smart way to give your money a chance to grow. Because Acorns is easy. You can sign up in minutes and start automatically investing your spare money, even if all you've got is spare change. And Acorns grows with you. Whether you're just starting out thinking about settling down, Acorns supports your big and small goals across every life stage. The Acorns potential screen shows you the power of compounding and how your money can grow over time. Plus, you can quickly adjust how much you're investing every day, week, or month to make sure that you're building towards your goals. Acorns is all in one. No more finance apps cluttering up your phone. And with Acorns, you can invest, save, and give your money a chance to grow in one trusted place. What I love about Acorns is that it's an easy way for you to get started in managing how your money can live. And there's no better resource than that. You know, we all need money to function in the world, and how we manage the money. A lot of us weren't taught a lot of things about it. I certainly wasn't. But you don't have to be an expert to start with Acorns today. Sign up now and Acorns will boost your new account with a $5 bonus investment. Join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $27 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/PSTP or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid not client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 2 compensation provided. Potential subject to various factors such as customers' accounts, age, and investment settings. Does not include Acorns fees. Results do not predict or represent the performance of any Acorns portfolio. Investment results will vary. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC Registered Investment Advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/PSTP.
Speaking of Democrats, you know, there is one Democrat who says that if you buck, she will nuck. And that is Ilhan Omar. We saw her get sprayed with some substance this week as she was holding a town hall and community meeting. We saw her security have to intervene. And we've seen a little bit of the, you know, brouhaha surrounding that. I watched that and immediately was terrified for her. I think especially as somebody who has been in Trump's crosshairs from the very beginning, somebody who represents a state that is also now in his crosshairs, right? And someone who's like a petite Black woman and who I think is like just physically, I could feel her vulnerability watching that. And I think, you know, watching her first be a voice of a more progressive wing of the Democratic Party in the face of a new wave of leadership, feel like she's still trying to hold that ground, even though we've seen other people, I think, Miles, to your point, become a little bit more moderate, right? And then in some ways tell us that they've had to in order to get anything done. But it feels like, you know, she's been trying to stay true to who she was and be who her people elected her to be. And I just think, you know, not that I don't believe that this country has the possibility or the potential to watch this happen and do nothing, but I'm just like, she's just out here. You know what I mean? Like, she felt very unprotected to me. And so I'm curious what y'all thought when y'all saw that footage.
Obviously, it was a horrifying video. Not making light of the moment that she just had, but, you know, in light of the other videos that we've seen, I think that it was also a comforting video that there was no blood. There was no, she's alive. So that was like a comforting thing to see, because we have not seen that on the left or the right side for a few years now. Like, you know, when we usually see videos like that. Two things. First thing is, I always get shocked in these moments how xenophobic we are. It takes me out. And, you know, I try to look at darkness in order so people's hatred doesn't surprise me. So I try to look at my own darkness and darkness of others so I can, like, kind of meet people there and meet those situations there. But, yo, a lot of Black people have surprised me how, like, they're like, hey, there ain't a Black woman and that's not our Black woman. So, like, that's always gonna kind of, like, gag me, if I'm being honest with it. And the second thing is how much I wish I could have a conversation with her and AOC and maybe even Zohran, and not for any other reason, but just curious as to what they really think. You know, I've been working on this essay for a minute called Hope is an Old Technology. And in that essay, I was really just thinking about how much people who peddle hope have been, like, peddling this, like, kind of soulless drug to people that has helped lull so many people to sleep, that has helped disillusion so many people. And because I see them as more radical choices, because I see them as more revolutionary choices, even though they're still inside of this system, it makes me wonder, where is their status of hope? Where are they finding it? And, like, what's really going on? Because what are you seeing that is making you stay in this fight outside of habit, outside of historical, moral allegiance to what your ancestors might have done if they were in this point? Like, so many people are mapping their current moves onto the 60s. And I'm like, so, that. What's going on right now? How are you really feeling? And what is going on in your job or with people that's making you feel like there is hope? And how do you translate that to other people? Because that would have me quit. And I need to know what's the ingredient outside of, because if you don't let us know, it does look like you're just a little bit of a liberal zombie. Because why are you doing that? Let us know your thought patterns.
Plus one, we are really xenophobic, but my push to the organizers, I have a lot of messages, this has been my new speech message to the organizers, is that I think people didn't think that fighting back against the xenophobia, like in organizing, was their job too. And then we got here and now you're like, now we're screwed because it's hurting all of us. And you're like, yeah, that is, you know, in a world of, you know, I just wrote this essay called A World Beyond Ice. And one of the things I say in it is that to a white supremacist, all y'all is immigrants. You know
yes,
what I mean?
Yes.
Like, you think it's between you and the Haitians and you and the Somali, as though to a white supremacist who believes in remigration and get rid of every non-Black person, a dumb immigrant means somebody that their citizenship status is negotiable. Like, white supremacists are not doing this country thing. They think that Black people are, like, they can decide tomorrow that you are not a citizen too. Miles, you look skeptical of that. I think it's true.
This is what the challenges to birthright citizenship are, right? Like,
yes.
It's like they're talking about quote unquote anchor babies, but every Black historian has been like, y'all, the next people up are going to be Black Americans who, for the most part, right, are descended from people who were granted citizenship under the Reconstruction Amendments.
This is how come I beg of y'all.
Go ahead. What you begging?
To listen to, like, where we're at, right? So to a lot of white supremacists, here's how come I actually have grown to think that's not true. A, I think a lot of white supremacists, specifically when I listen to Nick Fuentes and Asmund Gold, will they say racist things? Will they do stereotypes and all that other stuff? Of course they will. But one of the reasons why, like, academics is, like, still talking to Nick Fuentes and platforming Nick Fuentes is because there is this erasure of there being, like, a bloody Black genocide. So it's not the Klan's people coming into Mississippi. What most white supremacists think today, think Black Americans have already been defeated. And when you look at the statistics of us having a negative 8% wealth, when you look at our statistics when it comes to health, I'm like, well, hold on. You might, you know, have something there. When you look at anything you want to measure Black Americans on, we have experienced a social death. Most Black people, unless you have an intervention, a class intervention, are going to be a type of social zombie. That is just what this country manufactures us to be. And when I think like that, then my idea around the xenophobia, A, it makes me think of how fascism comes from those kind of pressure points and those kind of failures of an empire. And then it makes me think of less of, oh, maybe it was wrong by thinking fighting xenophobia was literally fighting xenophobia. Maybe we should find the pressure point of what is creating Black Americans to being so xenophobic. And it's because we have, for generations now, totally been looked over and totally disposed of and politically maybe getting to be next to the people who get chosen, but never chosen. So Barack Obama, Vice President Harris, these kind of icons and these archetypes and these symbols aren't really us. And then there is, if you look at somebody who is an immigrant who's Black and a Black American, the immigrant is going to probably have a better success story. And I'm not saying that it's because of immigrants. I hope that's very clear. But like, I'm not saying that's because of immigrants, but that is a very powerful to me pressure point, and it doesn't go away just by saying calling Somalis a stereotype is bad. It goes by, like, really, to me, it would go by organizing or having people think and feel around their pains and those pressure points that are making them feel that way and making sure they get it. That, again, I talked about housing and reparations and these things that kind of systemically can help Black people that just seem to be ignored now for police or prison, which I think is important work, of course. But then, like, or whatever the Democrats give us permission to care about, you know?
So I'm happy we're having this conversation because I'm, like, happy to hear the argument. I think the exact opposite. I actually think that white supremacists think that Black people are the last thing they got to get rid of. Our cultural power is so annoying to them and so frustrating and so... I am hearing the last stand of white supremacy being really frustrated with Blackness, that they can't just subsume it. And that it is like a roadblock to the plan, and it has historically always been a roadblock to the plan, that Black people were, you know, there's a scholar, Brandon Terry, who talks about how Black people were the, like, ended the moral case for slavery across the world. And, like, what that did to white people across the world was a thing. We index white supremacy differently because Nick Fuentes is not actually, like, is the arbiter to me. Like, I think there are other people who I think are more sort of carry that baton a little differently. He's just the loudest to me. But I actually read this as a moment where they realize that they need to foment xenophobia in Black people because it serves a political purpose, because Black people have so much and have always had the cultural capital, both here and everywhere else. And that drives them nuts.
I think what we're actually seeing is more people get recruited into white supremacy, right? Who are not white, or, you know what I mean? And I think we see that with, like, the leader of the Proud Boys, right? And I think in ways that are very clear, like the Proud Boys, and I think in ways that are more subtle, like La Roche dressing Lauren Sanchez Bezos, right?
Oh, like, brother.
So, and I think there is something about Black people being the arbiters of fashion, of cool, right? Of culture, that people are still trying to tap into while, like, not having to deal with Black people, right? And so what they do is they then recruit some of us who are high profile, who are cool, like a La Roche, right? Who are arbiters of cool, right? Who can design an aesthetic, who are image architects, right? And they recruit them to do their work. And so now you are like, okay, well, do I critique this look? Do I critique his choice, right? I'm just using a cultural example here because I think we're talking about Black cultural power. And if so, is that me critiquing this Black person whose success, because we've also talked about those, like, parasocial relationships that we often have with highly visible Black people, right? I'm invested in. So if I'm invested in La Roche getting the bag, being the person that everybody wants to go to, love seeing him on my TV, if I call him out for the choice to dress her, right, and to have her as a client, what does that mean? And I think that one of the reasons that he and other, you know, highly visible Black celebrities and cultural figures get tapped is because exactly this reason, right, which is, like, they recruit folks out of community. They recruit folks away from accountability, right? And then we find ourselves having a hard time lobbing criticism at people who look like us. And so I think it's a tactic. It's a tactic that seems to be working. And I think the ironically, the ranks of white supremacists are growing increasingly diverse.
Sharonda, yes, you are being absorbed into white supremacy. The point that I am trying to make is that I think Blackness is also just being absorbed in a way that is just quicker and more intense. It's not new, but it's just quicker and more intense. And I worry that sometimes in the public conversation, Black culture becomes synonymous with Black celebrity. And I want us to always decouple that because I think that is a misreading of the moment as well.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Blinds.com. If you've ever thought about upgrading your window treatments but didn't want the hassle, Blinds.com is here to change the game. They're the only company that lets you shop custom blinds and shades online, then backs it up with professional in-home measure and installation services. Are you tired of waiting around all day for an in-home design appointment just to get a quote? At Blinds.com, you can skip the stress and get expert design advice through their convenient virtual consultations on your schedule. I've needed blinds in my bedroom for a long time. I want blackout curtains. There's been nothing up. There was nothing up when I moved in. And that is a brutal, brutal thing, let me tell you. Whether you know exactly what you want or need a little help deciding, they've got you covered. Do it yourself or sit back and let Blinds.com handle everything from measure to install. Either way, you have access to experts every step of the way. Blinds.com makes it easy to get the designer look without the showroom markups because they're on a mission to make custom window treatments easy and affordable for everyone. You get the same quality and service you would at other high-end stores, but at a fraction of the price. And it's more than just blinds. Blinds.com carries everything from bamboo shades to shutters, outdoor shades for your patio, and more. You can shop with confidence because all Blinds.com orders are backed by their 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you're not happy, they'll make it right. They're breaking the mold, but they're not new to the game. Blinds.com has been around for 29 years and has covered over 25 million windows, making them the number one online retailer of custom window treatments. Right now, Blinds.com is giving our listeners an exclusive $50 off when you spend $500 or more. Just use code PSTP at checkout. Limited time offer. Rules and restrictions apply. See Blinds.com for details.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Well, one of the ways that white people have always tried to undermine Black political power in the country is by first locking us out of the franchise, right, our ability to vote. And then secondly, when they couldn't do that, figure out every which way to make sure that our votes were tampered with, et cetera. Duram, I'm gonna kick it over to you to kick us off on the news with your story.
I'm obsessed with voter ID, like as a topic, because Candace Owens, who I don't listen to, but somebody was recounting an argument that Candace Owens had. Somebody I love, respect, huge in my life, was like, you know, Candace made this great comment about that. And I was like, was it great? And so we have this whole conversation about voter ID. And he is like sold on voter ID because of Candace. So I'm like, I didn't know I knew people who listened to Candace Owens. Like, I literally just didn't know. And I'm like very close to him. And that put me down this road to be like, am I off or like, what's going on? So then I started asking some other people who like don't identify as activists because I was just like, what is the what? And I realized that we are losing on voter ID in places that like we should not be losing on voter ID. That like super left people have given up on voter ID and that the left's messaging about why voter ID is bad is just that voter ID is bad. There is no actual argument. It's just like voter ID is bad. And then Candace comes and says, you need ID to buy alcohol. You don't need an ID to vote. And people are like swayed by that. So that's how I got on this train. I'm like, I missed a voter ID. In the brouhaha around ICE, you might have not seen the Make Elections Great Again Act or the Mega Act. You get it? It's a play on MAGA, if you didn't get it. And in the Meta Act, it would do these things. It would impose strict photo ID requirement. It would create a centralized voter surveillance system in every state. It would mandate constant voter roll purges, gutting the motor voter law that was really important in expanding voter registration using DMV records. It would bar states from counting ballots that arrive after Election Day. It would ban universal mail voting, which states mail a ballot to all registered voters. It would bar the federal funding for voter registration by outside groups. And it would allow you to sue election officials. It would be the single biggest rollback of voting rights since a lot of us didn't have the right to vote, including Black people and women. There would be no other rollback greater than this, but besides those. And I was struck by this because, A, if I didn't have to prepare for the pod, I don't know if I would even know this. Like, I don't know if I would see it. None of my friends are talking about it. I just have to look at the news in a special way to prepare for us. So that made me nervous. And then the second is, like, they just are, like, really, they know they're going to lose the midterms if all stays the same. So they're like, ICE is going to be patrolling stations, so people aren't going to come outside. And we are actually going to just make this really, really restrictive. And I just wanted to bring it here because I don't know if voter ID is not my work. I am on the board of Rock the Vote, and shout out to Rock the Vote. But my day-to-day work is not on voter ID. And I am scared about just, we don't have an argument around this stuff. We take for granted that everybody just sort of understands that mail-in ballots are a good thing, or that you shouldn't be able to sue the election official because that feels crazy. Or people don't even know that it was a real activist fight to allow you to register to vote when you get a driver's license.
Yep.
Was like a battle that people won to get you registered to vote. Like that we just sort of, we forget those things over time. And this makes me nervous.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't even know what I would say to someone because the arguments on the other side do sound quite rational. You know what I mean? And I think we're so used to having ID to do any and everything. And so I'm thinking about how you help people understand the like systemic level impact that these kinds of requirements have. And again, like the chilling effect, right? So like, even if you can have an ID, you can produce an ID, et cetera, right? It becomes yet another barrier. It becomes yet another hurdle. And it feels like stuff that they're doing out in the open. You know, I was on a first date a few weeks ago and ended the date when he told me he didn't vote. And I take that so seriously. And now I'm like, well, shit, am I going to have to ask, like, well, was it the ID requirement that got in the way? And that's like a silly example, but I just don't know how I would argue, like, as I'm sitting here listening to you, why this is a set of bad moves, right? It seems logical. It seems in line with what we're expected to do anywhere and everywhere. I mean, even in some ways to get into our phones, right?
You know, I'm not super passionate about voting. I've dated and more than dated many of non-voters. but shout out to you and your privileged pool. I think what really hits me about this story is how when I think about people who are like in the Democratic establishment or anybody who's trying to like activate people, this is a horrible thing to activate people around too, right? Because to the point, what Candace Owens said is really logical. And then also, there are so many people who do really want immigrants out of their vote. And I'm using immigrants on purpose because it doesn't matter really if they're illegal or legal. There are so many people on the left or the right who are compelled by immigrants staying out of their vote and saying that you shouldn't be talking about this and this shouldn't be about people who came off the Mayflower or people who came through the Middle Passage. And those are the people who should be talking about it. So it's like interesting because it's like the more you advocate for it, it will be the more it looks like a party is trying to get, like the narrative is that, oh, you care about voter ID because you want more illegal immigrants to be able to vote so you can win and not do shit. And that is compelling to a lot of people. That's the story that I've always heard from people is that that's why the Democrats like voter ID. And I'm like, how do you get around that one?
Yeah, I don't know. DeRay, what do you say to that one, right? The like the
neither
Democrats
do they, want. Apparently.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, I think part of the battle is that we got to try. I think that we, like, what the right sort of has figured out is that, like, try everything and figure out what works. We, like, consultant. One thing doesn't work and then we sort of give up. You're like, what is going on? Shout out to the activists, don't do that, but the party definitely does that. And you're like, what are we? This is, we're losing here, guys. I think more people in my organizing have been swayed by the shadiness of voter ID than actually wanting vote, like, than sort of caring about voter ID as an issue. So if I tell them, did you know that in some places you can only use your, like, narrow state ID that was issued by this one office in the middle of whatever, they're like, that's crazy. They try that. Like, they are more motivated by, like, the insanity of them taking something away from you, whether you wanted it or not. That actually I've seen being more of a motivator than, like, the straight up, like, I want to vote, if that makes sense. So I remember I was talking to a big podcaster and I was talking about it. I pulled up his state's voter stuff. We're talking through it. And he's like, that's crazy. Because it was like a state where I was walking him through why it is bad that the state law says only universities accredited in your state can you use their ID to vote. He was like, this makes total sense. I was like, yeah, but what if you go to the University of Buffalo? He was like, oh, I couldn't use the ID to vote. You're like, he's like, no. And he was more outraged by that than sort of like the sort of value-based thing about voting, if that makes sense. And I'm sort of like, whatever gets you there. Like, I'm happy to, like, you know, whatever gets us to the thing, let's go.
Yeah. Well, my news this week is, speaking of, like, wanting to disenfranchise people. And we've been talking a lot about, like, the extractive nature of our economy. And as y'all also know, I have been obsessed with online gambling and online betting, right? And so I came across this story about a payday lender, essentially, in Tennessee, that in addition to pushing for what they call a flex loan, which allowed them to loan up to $4,000 to individuals at a 279.5 interest rate, people could, at that same window, right? I'm picturing the plexiglass now, right? Take some of that money and then bet on sports betting, right? And the story is about how a state legislator, through his connections with the owners of this business, ensure that that was possible, right? And we've talked a lot about, like, the gaps of regulation, how, like, our regulations are often playing catch up on stuff like this, particularly with online gambling and some of the prediction market stuff. But I'm bringing this here too, because we've also talked about, like, dollar stores and just all of the ways that, like, the economy in the hood is set up to rob you, and how incredibly expensive it is to be poor. And if you're borrowing money at a 280% interest rate, right, and also have the opportunity to gamble in the hopes of making it big, this feels like a place where, I don't know, people across party lines could come together and score a real win for poor people by imposing some sort of regulation here. But wanted to bring it to the pod, one, because I think people who are listening should know that this kind of thing happens, and then two, to hear y'all's reactions to it.
Sharonda, I actually have a question for both of you.
Sure.
Because I don't want to make any assumptions, because we've now talked about Kalshi, is that what it's called?
Uh-huh, and Polymarket.
Sharonda, what do you think, this is a push to understand, not a push to challenge, the government's, like, responsibility around gambling is?
I mean, gambling is a vice, right? As is alcohol. It is, right? Like,
okay.
And, like, we've always legislated and regulated our vices. You know what I mean? And, like, sometimes, you know, to a point where we're, like, legislating or attempting to anyway morality, that's not what I'm going for. But I am saying these, when you have an economy that looks like ours right now, we have the number of people who are stuck in the bottom rungs of our society, right? Where economic mobility is a farce, and people are trying to figure out the thing that they can do to make it big, to earn money. That might be selling pictures of their feet on the internet. That might be trying to place a sports bet and hit a parlay, right? But people are going all in out of desperation. And I think it's incumbent upon our government to protect us from these predatory entities. That is where I think we're losing the battle. It's not that these things exist. I don't have anything inherently against gambling, right? Like, I go to Vegas sometimes. I play my little $5 blackjack for a little while until it gets too rich for my blood, right? Like, I don't have any issue with that. I have an issue with the government and legislators in particular, right? It's why Donald Trump Jr. is one of the advisors for a prediction market, right? Knowing that people are spending their life savings from a place of desperation because there's no other viable pathway out of poverty and out of this cycle, and letting it happen to the benefit of the ultra rich.
Yeah, I think that was one of the like more disturbing parts of the article was that, wasn't it the gambling company?
Yes, it's in the lending place. Yes.
Yeah, I'm like, that is some nasty, nasty work.
Yes.
Can y'all explain it to people who don't get it?
So how I imagine it is that just like you will go to like a same name loan place, you could also gamble there. So like you could go and get this like $4,000 loan, and then also in the same complex or in the same whatever store, you can go ahead and gamble your money away as well. And it's right there. So you only got to make but two steps in order to ruin your life, which is a little wild. I think, if I'm remembering your question correctly, but I think that my stance is always that a government should be making sure that as many people in its society should be living in its highest expression, should be living specifically in a place like America that we should all be able to sustain when it comes to food and shelter. And that, to me, it's not really about just killing the predatory nature of these companies. It's about killing the atmosphere that makes that predation possible, and generating policies that make that predation less and less possible. So I'm not always convinced about going after the predator because it's going to be some new shit. Like, you know what I mean? Every single day, they even the poly market stuff, like that is so loopholed. Like in order to be able to get away with that, like they're always going to think of a different way. And then to do it, it's really about, to me, changing the container that we're all in that makes that kind of predation possible.
I love that. I asked because I don't have, you know, I feel like I spend so much time in a specific part of the world that I don't think I have a deep sense of what the government's responsibility is around sitting this, like besides like don't scam people and like, you know, make sure there are rules and fairness, which is why I wanted to know what you all thought. Like, people know gambling is not bad, but like, do people not know that payday lending is bad? Or is it the politics of desperation that allow these industries to remain? Like, I remember I cashed my first check at the corner store across my first job when I was 14 years old. And I was so pumped to get money that day that I was like, whatever. And I remember my father finding out, being like, DeRay, we got to open up a bank account. I'm like, bank account, Dad? I can get it right now. He's like, you signing over your da-da-da. I'm like, but it's a little bit of change. I just didn't know what a bank account, like, I didn't know anything else. And when I understood something else, I was like, okay, well, that, I'm not giving away my money to the, I just didn't understand it. So I guess I'm confused, like, how these things remain so widespread. I'm not confused at why people gamble, but I am confused by, like, the enormity of participation. Does that make sense? I'm missing something. I don't know.
I'm like, you watch any sports game now, right? Like, FanDuel is a sponsor, right? Like, they're coming at you every which way, and they are not talking about it as, like, gambling in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? People are like, oh, I placed a bet and I like won $5, right? And so no one thinks they're doing the kind of gambling that they're talking about on the bulletin board where they're like, call this 1-800 number if you, you know, it, because it's so subtle now, right? It's like, I think Giannis is going to hit a three in the third quarter, and then it happens, and then you've won your little $5, but you were watching the game anyway. It's your fantasy football league that you had to pay into. You know what I mean? It's like all these little ways that it is just slowly crept more and more into our lives. And a lot of the big sports leagues, right, again, having full-on official partnerships with these gambling platforms have benefited from it, right? Because maybe you would watch your NFL team on the, you know, the days they were playing, but now you've got this fantasy league and you can pick players from all across the teams and you're betting on all these different things or predicting what's going to happen here, here, here. And so now you're watching every game that's on because you got to watch players across teams, right? So everybody is vying for your attention and everybody is vying for your dollar. And the fact that those two things have come together in this way, and the fact that they're like, how do we get more money? Because you can't afford a ticket to go to the game, right? So how else do we get you to place bets on these things. How else do we benefit from this? And this is yet another way, like reaching deeper and deeper into our lives. But again, my visual is similar to what Miles described, right? I'm imagining a plexiglass window and I'm in line in this line to take my, you know, 280% interest rate loan. And then I'm in line in this line to bet on whether or not Rihanna and ASAP Rocky are going to have another baby. You know what I mean?
And America doesn't know that you can drown in shallow water just as much as deep. So I think sometimes we wait for like a big, deep tragedy to happen. You're like, oh, I started wearing black and white and swastikas. Oh, I guess we are not to do this. It's like, no, it could look goofy and still kill your ass. I think that like sometimes when it comes to like the nihilism and desperation and the suicide culture that we live in, specifically if you are somebody in an underclass, that we need to take off the Lee Daniels indoor Tyler Perry filter that we put on top of it. It does not always look like that. It looks like I just got some sneakers too, and this is just the life that I'm living. The life that I'm living today, I have no idea that it will be better next week. That's how I'm living those things. So even though the desperation is so in the air that I wouldn't say that like, oh, this mama got $5 and oh, I just need to, I'm just betting. Like, I don't think there's too much of that happening. I think it's just baked in. And I would dare to say, I'm just thinking out loud, but I would dare to say that these in-person places are trying to catch up to the digital spaces, because so many of the things, whether you're talking about Klarna, whether you're talking about Cash App having loans, even like I do invoice pay, and now in the invoice pay in the bill app that so many people who are in a gig economy and a freelance economy use, now they offer you, oh, you want your money faster? We'll give it to you, but we're just going to take 10 or 5%. So many of our new digital financial institutions have absorbed that predatory behavior. And I feel like what we're seeing now, one of the reasons why it's so ridiculous and so absurdist, like here's $4,000, here's a betting machine, is because so many people are taking their suffering and their desperation digitally, and brick and mortar is trying to keep up. So with more uplifting news, there's a trans genocide. There was a news article that went pretty viral, a report released by the Lipkin Institute that let us know that America is in the early stages of a trans genocide. There was a few reasons why I wanted to bring this to the podcast. I didn't really have anything to say directly about the article, like any like critique around it, but I wanted to maybe stretch it. Because I've been like really obsessed this week with Mulvaney. She was on the Bud Light can. She was a trans woman and she was on the Bud Light can. And Kid Rock and so many conservatives ended up taking their guns and spraying those Bud Light cans and saying no trans people on my Bud Light can. Mind you, it was one Bud Light can that Bud Light sent to her with her face on it. It was not like something you can buy in stores. And I instantly, when I saw this report, thought about that moment, because I think that, again, sometimes certain things aren't said until there's conservatives in office. And I get really annoyed by that because it was happening underneath Biden, too. And I'm not saying, of course, that Biden was responsible for it, but this is an erosion that's been happening. If we're not able to speak about it or able to talk about it seriously as something to be taken seriously and not just a quote-unquote culture war issue, then by the time it really gets the gas and people are able to absorb it into policy, it's really, in many parts, too late. I don't know any trans person in my life who is not looking to leave America. That is just what's going on. The second thing that I wanted to bring up around that is that trans in this article is used, but I think that's because language is a place of failure. So trans, most people, specifically, I know a lot of fishy girls, so like specifically for most people, trans is not something that you just know or that you just see. You know, if you can see it, that person is clockable, is what you would say. I can clock that you were born biologically male. So what this really is a genocide on all visibly queer people. So that's all people who transgress the established gender binary, which puts a bigger slew of people in danger and makes a bigger slew of people targets, people who would count themselves as trans and people who would not. So I wanted to put that as some perspective. And then also, as I've been reminded as soon as today, but then earlier this week, is that we have a nice white audience, a big white audience. We have a big audience of people who are maybe more privileged. And I see that as I get like comments and or like messages about like things that I've said or in stuff like that, and people telling me about you know, where their status is at in life. And I think that, like, this is the time to really, if you have any privilege, whatever that looks like, to really extend it to the trans people in your life. You know, if that's 1% of the population or how many, whatever percent of the queer people, if you own a glass making company, is 1% of your glass making company trans? like if you know what I mean? Like, if we know that the established net worth of Black people is -8, and we know that Black trans and queer people are the worst inside of the Black community who are doing it, are you doing things in order to, like, keep the trans people in your life safe, to keep them knowing not just where the fish are, but how to fish? You know, I can't even tell you how many times somebody has helped me, not just by, like, giving me something, but by teaching me how to do something or guiding me with something that has, like, saved, like, my life in so many ways and still does. Just last year, I tapped Deray and Sharonda to look at stuff, and that just does a lot for people. And I think sometimes we can be so either in our heads or individualistic that we don't think to really reach out. And now that this has been established as an early stage of a genocide, I think there's some things, tangible things that we should do. And it really just looks like seeing where you have accumulated wealth and privilege, and not just wealth when it comes to money, but where you have accumulated wealth and privilege, and how can you share that specifically with somebody who is trans?
Yeah. First, thank you for bringing this article. I've shared it with a couple of people in my circle. When I initially saw the headline, I was like, well, that's a statement. That's an assertion, you know? And I went in honestly like, okay, what argument are we about to make here? And I found it really coherent and compelling, right? Like, both, like, the case that's being made. I think you've added a couple of shades of nuance, Miles, that are also making me think I had not thought about, for instance, right? Like, anyone who is genderqueer, whether they identify as trans or not, is likely experiencing what's detailed in the research, right? Like, the targeting, the violent language, the being locked out of employment, right? An attempt to, like, destroy people who, to your point, don't fit neatly within that gender binary. The other thing that it made me think of is I have a couple of people in my life who have legally changed their gender marker and have gotten, like, passports and IDs and all of that. And they were the first people I thought of when I was reading this, right? Because clockable or not, right? They have legally said, like, I am trans, right? Or non-binary. And I think that I had not thought about the people who have not yet done that, right, who are also caught up in this. So even in thinking about the trans and non-binary folks in my life, I'm recognizing, based on just what you shared right now, the level of, like, privilege that they have had in some ways, right, to have employment, they got passports, right, those kinds of things. And so I'm definitely like, oh yeah, this is something that a much wider group is likely experiencing and will continue to experience. It also means, though, that this reported 1% is an undercount, right? That there's an opportunity for us to kind of broaden the number of people who see themselves as needing to act in response to what's happening here.
What I'll add is that I'm reminded that a genocide in the flesh is always preceded by a genocide in the language and in the story and in the narrative. And that has been happening with the trans community, especially in a really heightened way. I think about the most transphobic I've ever seen in public was during the election. I'd always seen transphobia just like I see homophobia, but it was just so normal for people in a way that I personally had not experienced during the election with Trump and da-da-da. And I simultaneously have seen, and this is, like, why the issue of we talked about earlier with, like, absorption, I've seen so many communities absorb, steal, pilfer things that only exist because the trans community gave them to us. You know, like, it's, like, sort of wild to watch, but I just have seen the mainstreaming of transphobia while also watching people steal, borrow, barter all the things from trans culture in a way that seems to be happening all at the same time.
One last little idea around this. So, also, what kind of pisses me off, not kind of, what really pisses me off about this whole conversation, too, is I think like, it needs to be studied. It will be studied how irresponsibly the trans conversation got absorbed into electoral politics and just got gutted of all meaning. Like, when I think about conversations around gender and being, these are philosophical existential questions that are okay to have in public. But because, in my opinion, like, Democrats won't actually come up with actual policies that and galvanize people, they kind of latch on to these issues where they're like, oh, we can do that. Oh, you just want to trans rights? Well, we can do that. Minimum wage is going to stay the same, though. Or these other, we're not going to do anything around healthcare in a universal way again, but we can like latch onto that. And I just think that it's been so irresponsible. And when I look at how everything's happened, like Mulvaney, the young trans girl who I was talking about, like she went to the White House. And I'm not saying she shouldn't have gone to the White House, but also she was less than a year in her transition, I believe, when she went to the White House. So like a lot of this in this kind of like absurdist, quick TikTok culture and trying to absorb that into politics has really backfired. And again, I think that we can drown in shallow seas just as much as we can deep. And I think that this was a deep conversation. Transness is a really deep conversation and it got shallowed out and it upsets me.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adre Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Milesy Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.